Hello, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Dynatropin. Dynatropin is a human growth hormone secretagogue, and it's the most effective human growth hormone secretagogue on the market. It's been demonstrated clinically to raise growth hormone levels by 50 to 200%. And it's available at warriorsoulagoge.com under supplements. That's warriorsoul, A-G-O-G-E. .com under supplements. Check out Dynatropin and optimize your human growth hormone today. This podcast is also brought to you by Warrior Soul Keto Camp. If you're interested in getting the fat burning, muscle building, and mental performance building power of ketosis, check out Warrior Soul Keto Camp at www.warriorsoulketocamp.com. This is Chris Albert, and welcome to episode number 46 of the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is our second installment of the Tales from the Blast Factory series. This series is titled after the name of my co-host Andrew Marr's book, Tales from the Blast Factory, which is available on pre-order from Amazon now, and I'll be including a link to that in the show notes. In the last episode, we got a bit into Andrew's story. Andrew served as a Special Forces Green Beret, and on his team, he served as the breacher. He was blowing doors off of buildings every single day, and he came back from multiple tours in Afghanistan without a scratch on his body. But through the process of being exposed to those low-level explosions and having that low-level shaking going on in his brain every single day, that created inflammation. And through brain inflammation, Andrew was no longer able to produce certain hormones that were keeping him mentally balanced and functional. And what we saw and where we left off was a man who was able to perform at an extremely elite level being worn down to a nub. Today, we're going to get a bit more into that. And we're going to get into a little bit more of the personal side of this story. You'll hear about a man who was not only worn down to a nub, but who was also extremely violent. A man who was full of rage, and he had no idea why. What I want you to think about while you're listening to this is that person out there who hasn't come across the information that Andrew was lucky enough to come across, or I guess you could say maybe it wasn't all luck, it was also persistence. You know, Andrew didn't want to accept his state. He would not accept being where he was. And I guess the lucky part was that he was able to realize that there was a problem in the first place. And so he went out and did something about it. But I want you to think about that person out there who is lost, who doesn't know what's going on. You know, how many thousands of service members have come back and have struggled to find their way and didn't feel right, and they didn't know why? How many of us have come back feeling lucky because we didn't have a scratch on our bodies, but only to face mental anguish and horror? And how many more with scratches on their bodies, with wounds that also face this? And the deep root of what we're going to get to here is that the medical model that's centered around traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress, the model of throwing pharmaceuticals at the issue and coupling that with psychotherapy, it's not really solving the root problem of anything. These are issues that are based in brain inflammation. And what Andrew has done above everything else in his process of healing is to try to inform the general public and the United States government about the fact that we were probably wrong about post-traumatic stress and the symptoms of traumatic brain injury all along. And through his book and through this podcast, Andrew's trying to make sure that no other service member ever has to go through the horror that he had to go through. And he's trying to ensure that our future warfighters don't have to deal with this. There are many more who are still suffering, and there are many, many of them who are suffering in silence because they don't know what's going on. So if you know somebody who's been having issues, if you know somebody who served and they have no idea why they feel the way that they feel, or maybe they've gone and sought treatment and the treatment's not helping, put them in touch with this episode. And with that, let's get into Tales from the Blast Factory, Installment 2.
This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and I am here once again with my co-host, Andrew Marr, medically retired Green Beret and traumatic brain injury. I don't want to call you a victim because you're not a victim, but a traumatic person who sustained a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, sounds good.
This is installment 2 of Tales from the Blast Factory. And these are lessons learned and stories from Andrew's life. And if you were with us last time, you know that we went through Andrew's story. We went through his process of becoming Green Beret, what his op tempo was like, his life while he was on deployment. And we left off just as we were getting into some of the extents of his injuries and the effect on his family. Andrew, when you think back to those days when your injuries were at their worst, the symptoms of your injuries were at their worst, what types of feelings does that bring up?
Well, now I'm able to, you know, I've done a lot of work in internal processing, and so it's a good question. I think when you're able to relive past experiences that had a high emotional quotient, without reliving or experiencing those emotions, that's when it's become wisdom. So you can look back there and you can look at it from a different perspective. You can look at it from somebody else's point of view. You can look at it from what's the lesson learned? How could I have done something different? And it took a long time to get to that place. When we wrote the book, you know, I thought I had dealt with everything, but lots of times, man, like, you know, I would get emotional and cry after reliving it and writing it. But I realized that that was a way of going back in there and working with it, you know, which they recommend for people who've had, you know, different various traumas or whatever, is to go back in there and try to relive it as real as you can and look at it through the eyes of what do I want to happen differently? You know, what can I do differently in the future if this happens? And so you're rewriting that script in your own mind and in your brain and your, you know, tapestry of your mind, so to speak. It's reliving it and letting it go and going through that process of healing. But being able to look at those past difficult experiences without the emotional attachment, I think, is the definition of wisdom. And, that's what I've worked hard to do. So I don't really get emotional, when I think about it, when I look at pictures, or anything else. I try to say, okay, I'm so thankful for the lessons that were taught.
Yeah. I trying to put myself in your shoes back in those days, and a few things to this story that I think really matter. You know, the fact that you came back from multiple tours in Afghanistan without a visible scratch on your body. Mm-hmm. And coming back to your family and coming back to this situation where you had two infant children, or one infant child and one on the way. Mm-hmm. And for all intents and purposes, believing that you came back without a scratch and completely healthy, but then having your body and mind start to fail out on you. Was there a feeling of helplessness there? Was there a feeling of disbelief?
Yeah, both. When you're experiencing, you know, those difficulties that we talked about on the last show, just an utter and complete malfunctioning. Or like I talked about when I was, you know, at NICO doing the memory test and unable to have any recall, or sitting down in the evening and a preview for a movie comes on and I ask my daughter if she wants to go and see it. And she's like, "Dad, we just saw that yesterday." And, you know, no recollection of it. And then, you know, going and to the point, like I said, to the breaking point where it's not something that you can necessarily hide or sit on anymore, and then asking for help. And initially, you know, treated as if I was making things up or was wasting people's time, you know, and just couldn't get any solid answers or understand, you know, I just wanted to understand the parameters. I'm like, if somebody can just explain to me the new parameters, I'll figure out how to live with it optimally. But it just wasn't the case. And I can remember when I had the blood clots, and I'm in the ER, and afterwards, you know, I'm in the hospital for the next couple of weeks. And I can remember just waiting. I'm like, somebody's going to come and explain to me why I had a deep vein thrombosis, which is a fancy word for blood clot, that broke off into my leg and went to both of my lungs, called a bilateral pulmonary embolism. Somebody's going to come in here and they're going to tell me why that happened, what to expect in the future, what to do differently, what can be expected, how can we keep, you know, these things from happening? And that answer never came. What came was when I was ready to get discharged, you know, I'm on a heavily medicated in there because of pain. They bring me the option of, they say, you're going to have to be on a blood thinner for the rest of your life because, you know, you have a factor 5 Leiden, which means you have a high propensity for this to reoccur over and over and over again. And so you're going to have to be on a blood thinner. And so here's 3 options for blood thinners. Pick one, and then let us know what you want, and we'll write the prescription, and then we can discharge you. And I was like, you guys got to be fucking kidding me. I'm like, I'm high as a kite. I just came off this difficult situation where both of my other children are in difficult spots and my wife gave birth. And you're asking me why I'm doped up on morphine to make a decision about a blood thinner that's going to have massive consequences one way or the other on how it's implemented and the effects that has. Because those come with a lot of side effects, man. I didn't know it at
the
time.
How many different medications were you on at the time?
Let's see. When was that? September. I was on that, you know, that's when I was on the high end, you know, double digits, you know, those pushed it to the, 13 is at the highest,
opiates and
opiate. Yeah. Yeah.
Benzos.
Yeah.
Benzodiazepines for you guys at home.
Yeah. Opiates, Dilaudid, stuffed, Adderall, Ambien, stuff for migraine headaches, stuff for the blurry and double vision, stuff for night sweats. I mean, anxiety, anti-depression, and multiple, not just one for anxiety, not just one for depression. And at their max end of the dosage type deals. But yeah, like, so I was waiting for an answer, and I think, but I'm so thankful for that, because I came to this realization that, okay, nobody is going to do this for me. You know what I mean? Nobody. And if I want to get better, for myself, for my family, and I, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get off all the medications, and I just wanted a return of the man of my pre-injury status. Cause we knew at that point, after the blood clots, being an operator was off the table. I mean, they had told me because you had too many head injuries, you know, you couldn't operate anymore. Excuse me, but I was still a hot commodity at that point, and I would have found my way back to a team. I knew too many people, and too many people knew me, and by experience and reputation, you know, I had job offers and other places. So I was looking to backdoor the system and to keep operating. But once I had the blood clots and, you know, it was in the file that I needed to be on blood thinners for the rest of my life. So they said that takes you out of any deployable status because you can't be on a blood thinner, cause you get nicked and just bleed out. So, you know, that was off the table. But, it was through that process that I realized that, again, nobody's going to give me the information. Nobody's going to do it for me. If I want to do this, I'm going to have to do it myself. And even at this, incapacitated state, so what? You're either going to get better or you're not. You don't like it, you can fix it, or you can just cease to exist. And that wasn't an option for me. So I went to work, man, trying to figure out, okay, what to do next.
How long between that process of, we talked about last time, the day you found out that you couldn't operate anymore. And how long was it between that date and the day you decided that you were going to try something else? The day you accepted not being a Green Beret anymore?
I got back from NICO in July. And it's funny because I went there thinking that that would be the tune-up and the fixing that would bring me back up to being operational. And I didn't know it, but it was the absolute antithesis of that. Whereas once I came back with all those things that they documented, that's when my command read my medical file from everything that, you know, was noted there. And they're like, bro, there's no way that you can do this anymore. So that was the end of July. Everything that went down with Jace going into emergency surgery, Becky going into labor, and then me getting put up with the blood clots was the first week in September. So we're talking 60 days, you know.
What were those 60 days like?
I don't remember them, man. I was blackout drunk. And medicated throughout the entirety. I don't remember much of it.
Wow. Then, and we're probably going to have to bring Becky on to talk about that, I think, at some point. Maybe.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, it was living, you know, my family was living with a 6'2", 230 muscle bound, you know, alcoholic demon. It's probably why my memory system shut off. It just doesn't want to remember those things anymore. Wow.
You know, I think about the story and I think about the ways that people learn. And you learn either through experience or you learn through simulation. And there are, for very good purpose, there are hundreds of books out there about military science. You know, through the ages, we can look at books and we can look at the things that other warriors have gone through where, you know, we can learn from their mistakes. Mm-hmm. We can learn from their strategies, what worked, what didn't work. There's rarely, in my mind, there might be a few books out there, but there's very few, if any, you know, texts that can take somebody through this process of dealing with an injury like this and coming out the other end okay. Mm-hmm. And when I think of your story, I think of a lot of guys out there who've been told that they're broken, who've been told that they just have to accept not being normal anymore. And, you know, at first I'm like, well, what the fuck is normal? Mm-hmm. What the fuck is normal? Right. Number two, why do we accept these types of things as truth from the medical authorities? Why, who are they to tell anybody that they're never going to be normal again? And I guess I can ask you, what is your advice to those guys out there right now who might not know what's going on with themselves, what's going on with their brains, who might be suffering in silence?
Well, the best way to look at it is, what do you want to happen? You know what I mean? What is the outcome that you desire? What is your end state? Do you have one? What is your intent? Because if you're just wallowing in self-sorrow and talking about how nothing works for you or nothing, you know, ever works, and, you know, you've made sacrifices and now you're dealing with these things, that doesn't end well. It never ends well. So the absolute first thing that anybody must do when they're in this state is they must decide to live a life worth living again, or for the first time. So if you're going through these things, you're like my story, which is so many other people's story. You find yourself on double-digit medications. You find yourself now having to supplement with alcohol. You find yourself not being able to function in the world at any capacity that you once knew. You have to figure out, okay, do I have something to live for? And what is it? And so that would be step two, is define your why, your reason for existence, your own mission, your personal mission. And everybody has one, but they have to find out what that is for their own life. And so that's kind of how the process went for me, deciding to live a life worth living again, saying what I'm doing now is not where I want to be. It's producing the exact opposite, and it is an absolute detriment to everybody I come in contact with, especially the people I love. And then defining your why. And for me, that was, again, I wanted to get off medication, and I knew I couldn't operate anymore, but I wanted to be the man, the father, and the husband to my family that I was pre-injury. And then after that, extending that why out to others, you know, and it was figuring out, okay, well, how can I fix myself And then if we find a process to do that, how can we deliver that same information and those same opportunities to everybody else? And that was, you know, again, extending that why. And then after you have the why, you can determine the how. If you have a big enough why, you'll always figure out the how. And then that was that process, figuring out my why. The how just started to illuminate itself by knocking yourself out of that self-sorrow, you know, negative line of thinking. And from there, it was dedicate my life to others with acts of selfless service. Because I think, you know, at our core, you know, if you can find a way to make your life about somebody else or adding value to somebody else, that's gonna add value to you. So if you don't know what your purpose is, you don't have a mission. I said it last week, and I said it many times. My dad gave me this advice when I was, you know, at my breaking point, and it was, son, I can't understand everything that you've been through, but if you could just find a way to make your new mission in life about helping other people, that will help you. I don't think he understood the magnitude of that statement when he said it. I certainly didn't, but it stuck with me. And later on, you know, that's what kind of continued to pull out. You know, how can I take this information back to the other people that I love and hopefully give them the same opportunities at a high quality of life again?
You talked about that day, the day when your wife was giving birth to your last son, or your youngest son. You talked about the day, all in the same day, your son Jace was affected by
lymphatic malformation, essentially a growth in his neck. Yeah.
And so he had to go into surgery the same day. And then you end up with a deep vein thrombosis. And so you're all in the hospital at the same time.
Yeah, we were all in the same ER first, because we went there for Jace, because his neck just ballooned up. And then Becky went into labor, so... And then my calf was killing me. So we're all triaged there in the same room in the ER. Then they moved Jace to, I think, like the fifth floor for emergency surgery. And Becky goes to the second or the third floor as she's going into labor. And I'm going back and forth between the fifth and the second, you know, and I'm just a hot mess. And at this point, I'm dragging my leg because I can't walk. And so I'm like just hobbling and dragging and going between the fifth floor and the second floor to be with both of them as much as I could.
So you realized that that was the day when you realized that you needed to change, right?
Mm-hmm.
In your mind. So we talked about on that abstract level, find your why, you know, figure out what that is, figure out what your purpose is. We always talk about Professor Jordan Peterson. And he talks about, you know, start by cleaning up your room,
mm-hmm.
straighten yourself out, right? What was the first action you took after coming to that point? Where'd you start?
Yeah, I locked myself upstairs in our bedroom, and I started going through the literature as good as I could. To, you know, again, it was like, okay, where's the information? How to delineate fact from fiction? What, I haven't been doing any of my own research. I've just been accepting everything that I've been being told. And I'm going to go and I'm going to try to figure out this process. I'm going to try to figure out why dudes are killing themselves. I'm going to try to figure out what this is all about, because they're only... my symptoms are being managed, are attempting to be managed, and that's it. Nobody's trying to get at the underlying condition. So at that time, I had no idea what the underlying condition was, but that was my mindset. We're going to find it, and I'm going to go out there. I'm going to find every other alternative means that's providing benefit to other guys, and I'm going to try it for myself. And so that's where my focus started. It was, get off the medication, find out what is the root cause and how to treat that.
And so you did this research, and then you came across Dr. Gordon's work, or he came across you, or were you out there on the internet scouring and things like that? Or
so I'd already been when Dr. Gordon first reached out to me. I had already been to a number of establishments outside of the Department of Defense's healthcare system. So we essentially had to pay for it our own, or I had to contact other nonprofits and get supported to go out there that way, because the unit wasn't going to pay for it. And matter of fact, I had to take leave to go and do those things. They wouldn't even allow me to go without taking leave. And so through that process, you know, I realized that we wanted to start finding out the nonprofit world. I was like, man, I want to start a nonprofit. I want to help other people. And so, you know, we went through the process, filled out the paperwork, got that going without really having a clear focus, you know, or something to offer, just wanting to help. Because I went to those different therapy places, you know, some in California, some in Texas, and just all throughout the country, got some press with that, and Dr. Gordon saw it. It was an article, I think, in Forbes or Fox News, one of the two, or maybe both. I don't remember, but he saw it. He contacted me, and because at that point he was looking at possibly developing his own 501c3. But he realized, like, he just didn't have the time and to put his energy into that, and also, you know, the clinical application and his practice. And so he's looking for other military nonprofits out there that he could possibly partner with. It was just kind of a match made in heaven, I guess you could say. He read up on that article, which was talking about a functional neurology center in Texas. And the article had a lot of, you know, background information about me and my symptoms and everything else. So he contacted me through email. You know, he said that this is my credentials. This is how we treat TBI. And he gave some media. And I've listened to the media, Joe Rogan and Matt Gosney and Mark and who was the other person on there? It was the writer for the American Sniper. Was on that, and it was just a phenomenal episode. And so after I heard that, you know what I mean, I was like, oh yeah, I'm contacting Mark. So contacted him, talked to him. He was interested in you know, kind of forming a partnership. But first thing was first, and that was treating me. And so while I was out in California at a place called the Brain Treatment Center, I went up a little bit north to link up with Mark in LA and got the lab. He drew blood and gave me the provocative shot of testosterone, a special blend he had, to see how I would react to that. And, you know, that started our process for the protocols with him. And then that was like February of 2015. And I think by May of 2015, we were already running, raising money, and we're running other people through the protocols. May of 2015.
When he took your blood, what did your blood come back like? What were you deficient in?
I was deficient in every major hormone, and not just by a little bit. You know what I mean? It was like... it was like the third lowest testosterone or free testosterone he'd ever seen. And, you know, it was all in the tank. DHEA, pregnenolone, testosterone, growth hormone. I actually think my thyroid was okay. You know, cortisol was elevated. And it's either, you know, all the way up, or it was a crash from adrenal fatigue, and then all the markers for inflammation were there as well. And so it was, and then he could, you know, through all the medication I was on, he could say, okay, well, this is why, you know, you're having a problem with dopamine and, you know, these neurotransmitters, and this is why this is affected and this is why that's affected. And, you know, this is low because of this. And, you know, it all has to correlate with the head injuries. That was the initial findings.
Yeah, being deficient in those types of hormones, particularly, you know, testosterone, free testosterone, when you've got low DHEA, when your cortisol crashes, that is, you definitely end up in a hospital bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely...
Yeah, you've been there.
Yeah, I've definitely been there. It feels like absolute hell. And you lose all the water in your body, you drop weight like crazy, and your brain just doesn't work.
Yeah.
The testosterone is definitely something that can affect mood. It can affect violent behavior. Mm-hmm. It can affect depression, all types of different things.
Yeah.
Now, add to that the combination of medication you're on. Now, I'm not a doctor, but... heard statistics, something like the benzodiazepines, a large percentage of people who either commit suicide or commit homicide are on benzos.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've had people on this podcast, you know, presenting us with statistics about people on opiates.
Yeah.
Person dies from an opiate overdose every single day. Every 19 minutes.
The benzo was crazy, man, because when I came off of that, like, we had to titrate it very carefully because people would go in and have seizures coming off of it. You can't just come off of a benzo cold turkey. So you know, I just thought, wow, that's fucking crazy.
How long of a titration was it?
A couple of months. A couple of months, and you know, I wouldn't recommend this, but you know, they recommended I titrate everything else, and I didn't. I just said, "Fuck it, I'm done with it," and I accept the consequences, and whatever comes as a side effect from not having it or not being on it, well, at least it's just from my own body and not anything else coming in, you know, as an outside external source. You know,
so did
again,
you do that with the opiates too?
Yeah, I do that with everything minus the benzo.
Wow. And so what were the withdrawals like?
It was difficult, man. It was difficult. I think being on the antidepressants and the anti-anxiety, it numbs you. Or you can think about it like putting a blanket over all those negative or difficult emotions. And it, you know, you kind of, you're just kind of numb. Nothing affects you. It's like zombified. And it got to the point where I was like, you know, whatever this was covering up, it's not worth it. But it was difficult, man, because at that point, you know, I became aware of all the difficult emotions that were, you know, unbalanced. So dealing with rage, not anger, not irritability, which was there, but I'm talking rage, like burning fuel, fueled by fire, rage. With no cause, and that's a difficult state to be in. And then the opposite end of that spectrum, the depressive, you know, bouts and the bouts with anxiety and all this. And again, trying to figure out like, what the fuck, man, like this never was the case. I can't see anything. I'm like, you know, and then you worry like, what if it's not my brain? What if my brain's okay? What if this is like, I don't know, man, like, am I just making this shit up? You know, like I thought that for a while. I'm like, am I just making this shit up? Like what the fuck is happening? So it was difficult, man. It was difficult, but I realized at that point, you know what? I'd never dealt with emotions never thought about it. And just kind of repress it or push it to the side, or, you know, and go and do what I felt I needed to do. And so that was the first time in my life I was really, you know, face to face with nowhere to go. I didn't have my teammates anymore. You know, you get off that train, the train doesn't stop. And I definitely understood that. But, I remember thinking, I wrote this in the book, you know, it must feel what it's like when you die, because nobody can do it for you. And you have to own it, and you have to just fucking write it. And, that's the kind of the conclusion I came to. I was like, hey man, again, nobody's going to do this for me. I have to own these things, whether they're coming from brain damage or not. Try to figure out, you know, how can I trace it back, and how can I overcome it to live some type of semblance of a life?
And, you know, you talk about rage. We were talking about a specific incident the other day, and we might have talked about it on the last episode, but
yeah.
Can you take us back to that parking lot incident that you had?
Yeah. Yeah. I was coming out of McDonald's I was going to the airport. I think I was going to get some treatment or something in a different state again. And, so we have my two boys. One is just like, a couple of months old. So Jace is like less than a year and a half. And my daughter is, like four. And so I come out, man, and you know, this kid, he might've been 18, he might've been 16. I don't know. But like, you know, he was just being a jackass. And he took this cup and he threw it on the sidewalk and just cursing and using all kinds of foul language and just being difficult. And I didn't like that. And I told him to pick up the cup and to throw it away and to clean up his language. And, you know, there's kids and family out here. And he told me to go fuck myself. And I said, you know, hey, pick this up and throw it in the trash and clean up your act. And he said it again. And I just reached back and I fucking backhanded him. I didn't even punch him. I backhanded him and he folded like a accordion. And then, I picked him up and I threw him into a street of oncoming traffic.
Yeah. And so for those of you who can't see Andrew, he's 6'3"?
Yeah. 6'2", 6'3".
And at that time you were benching what? 400.
Yeah. I was a big dude, and you know, it was probably some social justice warrior, that, you know, is, you know, oh, you can't do that. And what are you doing? And it was a chick, and she came up and she was all yelling in my face and everything else. And I was like, lady, back up. You don't understand what's going down, and you don't understand what's about to go down if you don't get out of my face. And then, like, you know, three or four guys wanted to act tough. And so I went through that scenario last week. And, again, I remember, I dropped that last dude and I looked up and there's my wife breastfeeding our youngest son, and my two youngest children are also looking on. And that's when I realized, like, man, like I don't have any control over my actions anymore. And again, not only am I a liability to myself, apparently I'm a liability to everybody I come across, because my thoughts and my actions aren't in alignment. And when I get pushed or triggered, it's like stop. It's this train locomotive that gets going. That, I mean, get out of the way, man. Just let it run its course.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we look at children and how they can't control their emotions. And I guess when the brain is not at a point where you can control those things, it's kind of like going back to being a child where you can't control your temper.
No, that's a great analogy, man. I mean, I think it's a lot like that. And so now getting on the other side of it, like, my God, man, my worldview has changed on everything, especially with Dr. Gordon's education. But again, looking at like the criminal justice system, how many people are incarcerated right now that they didn't have any control over their actions? Mm-hmm. You know, they got so enraged, and they most definitely are deficient or insufficient in these areas, or they're plagued by neuroinflammation, and their brain is not working correctly. You know what I mean? And they're committing these acts that they don't really want to, or they don't have any control over. You know what I mean? Because that was, that would have been on tape, and you know what I mean? Our law enforcement would have been there. Like, I'd be in prison right now. You know what I mean? And so again, that's for something that I had no control over. It's crazy when you think about it, but, that's where it was at.
So when you started the treatment with Dr. Gordon, you had that initial shot of testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then that's a tester shot.
Yeah. He calls it a provocative testosterone injection, just to see how you respond, see if there's any benefit to it, because we didn't get the lab tests back yet, and just taken it that day. So he gave me the shot. I'm driving south on the 405. Maybe an hour later, I'm in bumper to bumper traffic, and I realize that I'm singing to the radio. And like, I'm totally at peace, and I'm not having any problems. And for like the last year, I had had this fist, like an actual feeling of a fist in my stomach, like trying to come out, and it was gone. And so I was like, oh my God, this is, it's like I could breathe for the first time. Like somebody took the x-ray guard when you go to the dentist back in the day and they put that over your chest, like somebody took that off of my chest, and I could breathe fully for the first time in a long time. And I was like, ah man, I don't know what's going on, but I feel really good. I'm not having any problems. I feel like my old self. I feel like talking. And so I called Becky, and we had a phone conversation for about an hour. And up until that point, like, we hadn't had a conversation in a long time other than yes, no, or anything else. I just wasn't capable of carrying any type of conversation like that.
It's funny because, you know, a lot of people, when they think testosterone, they think roid rage. They think, you know, people going crazy. They think, you know, the way you were acting when you didn't have any testosterone in your body.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some stigma issues, I guess, surrounding bringing this kind of treatment to the military, bringing this kind of treatment to veterans. And I want to get into those in a second, but what other kinds of treatment did Dr. Gordon have you on? He had you on some nutraceuticals as well, right?
Oh, yeah. The protocol was robust. A bunch of nutraceuticals, replaced, you know, everything, all the key hormones, we replaced them to their physiological levels, anti-inflammatory protocol. I think a lot of the stuff we've discussed prior, but, you know, that was the root of it. The root of the backbone of every protocol is this, that we've put people on, is to reduce the inflammation and to bring up their neurosteroids, they're neuroactive steroids, which is a fancy word for hormones that are produced both in the brain and the body, bring those up to their natural physiological levels based off the individual and how they're feeling, not just a lab range or a test range, and then, you know, work from there and fine tune from there. But that's how we do it, and that's how we've been able to have such great success.
And that's important to mention, because it's not going to happen from just going out on the street and buying a vial of testosterone or, you know, abusing steroids. And it also won't happen because of the last point you mentioned, as far as to how the person feels. There's so many endocrinologists out there, or anti-aging doctors, who they bring it up to the range. They do it by the range. They don't do it by how the guy feels.
Yeah. So they're treating numbers and not individuals. And that's the difference with what we're doing with the Millennium Warrior Angel Foundation, you know, project, TBI project, is it treats the individual and not the numbers.
Now, back to what you guys are doing with Warrior Angels and everything we're doing here with this podcast. You've been trying to advocate to get this type of treatment to the military, trying to get it to people who've suffered from traumatic brain injury and to more veterans. Now, there's been some obstacles there from the military, and let's just talk about those for a couple of minutes, and I want to pick up for the next episode on this particular issue. Mm-hmm. But I want to frame it, we're in a military now where people can get hormones to change their gender,
mm-hmm.
right? Which I'm not against if somebody wants to serve their country, absolutely. But when we're denying people who have fought and who have sustained these types of injuries access to things that could potentially help them simply because of a stigma, where have you seen that? Or you probably can't talk about everywhere you've seen that, but
with the gender issue, to each their own, man. But if you're in the military and you're not sure of what gender you want to be, then how are you going to be able to operate with everything else? You know what I mean? If at your core, you're undecided on what your gender is, regardless of, your biological makeup, then I think there probably is an issue with that, Chris. You know what I mean? You shouldn't be on the front lines thinking, well, what am I? You know what I mean?
As far as everything goes, I don't have an issue with anybody who wants to serve or I don't have an issue with anybody identifying with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In my mind, I'm very libertarian, as far as things go. I'm very conservative on most issues, but as far as personal freedoms and things like that, but you are correct as far as saying if you're serving on the front lines and you're having an identity crisis, that's definitely not the place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely agree with you 100% there. My point is basically that I think it's a tragedy that there's kind of a double standard there.
Well, it's crazy. Yeah. So, that's the government's position right now. They will pay for an individual to change their sex. They will pay for the surgery. They will pay for the hormones needed, but the people that have been doing the job and have now become deficient or insufficient in these hormones as a result of inflammation, they're not given the benefit of the doubt. They're not given an opportunity. Matter of fact, they're told if you do put these things in your body, we will kick you out. And I know people that it's happened to, and so it's real. So that's bananas, man.
Yeah.
That's bananas.
Yeah. That boggles my mind. It boggles my mind that there's people out there right now serving in the front lines who have these injuries.
Yeah.
They may not know it, but who have these injuries.
Yeah.
But they would be denied access to this stuff. Whereas somebody who wants to change their gender, regardless of where they're at,
mm-hmm.
they can get access to that.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part for me to digest. That's where I think the tragedy is. Because we're looking at these things as if they are, in this kind of like box.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is it's uninformed, and are ignorant, are unwilling to change your viewpoint. You know what I mean? It's one of those three things. That's what we've come up against. And, we're so gung-ho about changing the government, changing the military at first. I think that's the last thing that will change. I think history has shown that. Because that system doesn't serve, the people that need those things, the people that aren't affected, are the ones that are making decisions. Well, it doesn't bother them, so they're not going to change anything. So how do you change it? You change it by offering a superior alternative, and you back it up with evidence. And then, you know, you take it to the ground level, and you help to affect or help to heal as many people as possible. And when you get enough momentum, you get that breaking point where change is going to happen, irrelevant if the government gets on board or not. So at that point, they can either be, you know, a good guy or a bad guy. But with the way technology is advancing, the way the laboratory technologies are advancing, where we can, to lower the cost of labs, it's the protocols of them in and of themselves are not expensive, absolutely not expensive, especially when you compare it to the standard, which is medication and psychotherapy. That's very expensive, and so it's these reasons, and it actually works. I think that we continue to do the same track we're doing it. You know, it's grassroots. Yes, we have some footholds in some places in government and military, but we're going to continue on the track that we're doing, is putting out this information. And so you, the listener, whether it's you yourself, a family member, a friend, whoever, you can put them in contact with this information, and you guys can start following all the breadcrumbs that we've left and go out there and put it together for yourself.
You know, one of the things, though, is the military is going to follow the medical model as a whole, right? So when we think of the medical establishment as a whole, they, for the past 50, 60 years, since 2010, we've known that saturated fat has no association with heart disease.
Right.
Right. But, you know, as late as this week, the American Heart Association released a report saying that people shouldn't eat coconut oil. Now, there have been natives across the world who've eaten coconuts and coconut fat, and they had extremely low rates of coronary heart disease mm-hmm. up until they were exposed to the Western diet.
Right.
Right. What I see is the biggest obstacle here is the fact that our medical establishment is not made to heal people.
Right.
It's not made to cure you. If it was made to cure you, then there wouldn't be an industry centered around it. And I have absolutely no problem with capitalism mm-hmm. or making money. But the doctors aren't changing anything. They're not treating the actual disease or the root cause of the disease. They're focused on alleviating the symptoms.
Right. Well, you know, trauma medicine is fantastic. It is as good as it's ever been. And it's saying, okay, how can we allow this person to live? You know, how can we keep them alive? Mm-hmm. Man, we are the best at that. Mm-hmm. We are the absolute best at that. It's everything afterwards that is less than, you know. And so, you know, that's one area. But I think the average... I knew these stats better when I was on the media circuit, but I think it was like the average wait time in a doctor's office in America in 2015 was like 70 minutes. And then the actual time that you spent conversing with the doctor was 7 or 9 minutes. So what can anybody do in 7 or 9 minutes? I mean, you can write a prescription for something. You know what I mean? You can't do anything else, but it's not the doctor, so to speak. Now they've got put in this very difficult position with insurance and everything else. And, they couldn't do anything else. And, once pharmaceuticals kind of took over the, medical schools and things like that, you know what I mean? They don't look at nutrition. Like, I think less than 6 hours of a medical degree is spent on nutrition. I could be wrong.
It's less than an hour.
Okay. Well, you know, there you have it. So no concept of real nutrition and a heavy dosing and pharmacology, which is needed. But if that's what makes a doctor today, how can you figure out how to really get to what's causing it as opposed to just managing symptoms? You know what I mean? So if you think about it in those terms, it's a pretty good business model. when you can tell somebody, okay, you're going to be on this medication for the rest of your life. And that, you know, the person says, oh, okay, well, doctor said that. And having no idea that, you know, taking a medication like, for instance, what's a good example here? One to lower cholesterol, okay, a statin, for instance. A statin will rob you of every hormone that you can produce because it serves to essentially render your cholesterol as low as possible. Well, every hormone branches off of cholesterol. So you need cholesterol. It is well documented and researched. But people are getting put on statins long term, and none of those other areas are being looked at. None of those other hormones are being looked at. And so now they're told, okay, you're on a statin for the rest of your life, and eat a low fat diet. And, you know, continue to do things this way. And we can't figure out why people are still, we have more people dying from, you know, heart attacks than before, when we put them on statins. And so it's obviously not the issue.
And lots of people dying from heart attacks with low cholesterol.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's documented.
Yeah, I mean, getting into the medical community, I mean, that's just one aspect, right? So, it's a system that is failing, you know, for those reasons.
It's crazy, and you know, I think that's about all we've got for tonight for this episode. And you know, stay tuned for the next episode of Tales from the Blast Factory. We're going to get more and more into this issue. And into where we hope that the medical establishment, the direction that the medical establishment is going to go in terms of treating veterans, in terms of treating traumatic brain injury, in terms of understanding where post-traumatic stress comes from and what types of things could contribute or cause post-traumatic stress beyond the trauma itself. You know, these are all things that people aren't thinking about. We're taking too many things as truth, and we're accepting that people are going to be injured for the rest of their lives when there's still potential out there for them to heal. There's still potential out there for them to improve their lives, and there's still potential for them to take charge of everything they need to take charge of in order to live the life that they should be living. Andrew, you got anything you want to end off on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we used to think that people get old and then their hormones get depleted. We now know that hormones get depleted, and no matter your chronological age, that person becomes old. You know what I mean? So that's why I think we're going to turn the corner here with this wellness revolution. Because when we realize we can take control of that, and we can live a high quality of life when we're optimized, then people, once you get a sniff of what that life is like, you're never going to want to go back to the old way of living. And I think slowly but surely, as a whole, our culture, our society is starting to understand that. And that's why I think, you know, it's important what we're doing and what so many others are doing. And this is how we're going to be able to take command and control of our health again, and not just give it up to the doctor, you know, or your money to the banker, or your child to the school system, and, you know, your spirituality to the priest, as I read in an article the other day. And so, you know, we're going to take control of these areas back, and I think this is where it starts, the health. I think we can take care of health. We can have this massive expansion and evolution of consciousness at a global level, and I think it can be ignited by this wellness revolution.
Awesome. Well, thank you for telling us more of that story, Andrew, and we will be back at you next week. We've got a few different awesome guests coming on, and we'll be back at you with another episode of Tales from the Blast Factory within the next week.
And it's up on Amazon now for pre-orders.
So
we got TalesFromTheBlastFactory.com, and then Tales is on Amazon now as well.
Yes, I will definitely be putting the link for that in the show notes, and along with some notes from this episode. So it's getting late, guys, and you can probably tell by the slurs in my speech that I'm getting tired. So we will talk to you guys next week.